I'm Sarah, I'm an addict.
I hate talking in these things. Thank you for asking me here, Eddie, wherever you are. I think I'm happy to be here. It's a big meeting. I'm an addict. And the amazing thing about where I am today is I'm just over 12 years clean. And it's a bloody miracle. I mean, an hour clean is a miracle, a year clean is a miracle, decades clean is a miracle, and I never ever thought that I could live clean. The way I used from about the age of 13. I never felt comfortable in my own skin. I never felt anyone understood me. I never felt part of the universe or the world or my family or my school. I just was never quite right anywhere. I was kind of attracted to sort of dodgy looking people as I was growing up, and, you know, long hair and bell bottoms and all that sort of thing, and people who were using various drugs, and, you know, I thought I was a bit of a rebel and that's where I belonged. But even there, really, I didn't feel at home. And I don't know, I just, for me, it was purely about trying to feel comfortable. And I suppose it worked for a while, you know. I started off drinking, and I remember I was on school holiday. I was at boarding school, which I hated, and I had a school friend for the half term. And we were both 13, and I got horrendously drunk at my sister's house, and I just was so ill, and I really embarrassed myself, and my friend was really shocked, you know. She, what the hell are you doing, you know? And the next night I did exactly the same again. I got in exactly the same state. I embarrassed myself again, and kind of this was a pattern for me. I kind of fumbled through life, really, and at a very deep level, I could see that I was out of control, but it was like watching a crash about to happen, but I didn't know how to stop it. And all the time, I remember doing things and kind of, I could feel inside me this wasn't what I was supposed to be doing, but I did it anyway. And then I felt really bad about it afterwards, and, you know, so that cycle of using went on and on and on for a really long time. I can hear from my voice, I'm really nervous, sorry. Take a breath. Anyway, I was very out of control. I was out of control at school. I got kicked out. I was pregnant at 16. This was because I was raped, because I got drunk in a pub, and, you know, years later in recovery, when I thought, you know, this person did this thing to me, actually it was me who put myself in that position, because I was drunk and I didn't know what was going on, and, you know, I had to live with the consequences of, you know, abortion and all that, and I had to leave school, and just everything started going wrong very quickly for me, and I just didn't know how to live. I remember hearing somebody share not so long ago that it was as though everyone else had the instructions to life, but they didn't. And this is exactly how I felt. I didn't know how to do life. And I didn't have any help around me. You know, the way my family carried on was, you know, we all made jokes about each other. We all, you know, my dad had these amazing sort of Victorian ideas, like, you know, any babies cried, stiff upper lip, you know, you should think yourself lucky. And if I complained about anything, he would, you know, I wasn't allowed to say how I felt. So in a way, I was taught to lie from a very early age, and that's how I got by. I lied about who I was, about how I was, and I sort of piled down a lot of drugs to help me live with that. And You know, I think there probably were good times in between, but to be honest with you, I don't get any euphoric recall. All I remember is the bring down and the depression and the, you know, I got into one relationship after another and they were abusive and it was just, you know, it just went on for such a long time. And, you know, when I got married when I was 20, seemed like a good idea at the time, to a South African guy who was, he was a heroin addict, basically. And so I got into that, and the shit really hit the fan when we got together, and I ended up in prison a couple of times. I was forging prescriptions for Dicanol. I was a mess. Somehow, you know, in and around this, I was working. I was actually, it seems ridiculous when I say it, but I was working as a belly dancer. And, you know, on the one hand, I was wearing these beautiful costumes, and on the other hand, the bangles were getting higher and higher up my arms because the track marks were starting to show. And, yeah, I don't know how I did any of it, actually, but there were about sort of 5 or 6 years when I was on heroin when I really couldn't do anything. I wasn't working, I wasn't doing anything, and I was getting drugs from psychiatrists and people like that, you know. And in the end, they stopped. They said, you know, either you go into treatment or you're on your own. And so I did it on my own, and I actually came off heroin, but I drank through it. So I drank till I fell over, and, you know, but I came off heroin, so I thought, I'm all right now. But, of course, there was everything else, pills and powders and all the other stuff, and it went on and on. But I did get back into work again. I moved back up to London. I started dancing again. And I had times when, you know, I won't say I wasn't using, because I was always using. If it was just drinking pills or, you know, whatever was around, I would have some of it. But I managed to keep my shit together for quite a while. And I even saved some money and I bought myself a flat in Shepherd's Bush. And, you know, the relationships continued. They got more and more sick. And I always knew there was something wrong, but I didn't get what was wrong. I didn't understand that I was an addict. I don't know how it escaped me, but I was so deeply in denial. I just didn't see it for myself. You know, I remember my sister saying to me, why don't you go and put yourself in the Priory? And I said, well, what for? I didn't know what she was talking about. Anyway, so I fumbled along for another few years, and in the end, you know, I stopped having relationships with men. I thought, there's something really wrong. I don't know what it is, but I need to keep away from relationships. So I did that. And the last year before I came into recovery, my using really kind of took off again. And I'd made this kind of rule to myself that I would never use, you know, stuff like coke and that at work. And then suddenly one day, one of the places where I was dancing, the boss said, do you want a line? I said, all right. And do you know, when I said yes to that, I was working in about 4 different places and I'd go from one show to the other, and suddenly it was everywhere around me and everyone was using it and everyone was offering it. And so I was taking it, and it really got very out of hand. And I shocked myself, you know. I thought, what the fuck, you know, what's going on? I thought I was okay now. And I started taking ecstasy. And then, anyway, fast forward to age 43, and I'm living in Shepherd's Bush, and I've been sort of drinking and using a bit of coke, and I ended up one night about 2 in the morning on Shepherd's Bush Green, and I was sitting with this homeless guy, and poor bastard, I was more depressed than he was, I think, and I bought him some fags and some cider, and I'm a poor guy, you know, I hope he's okay. And I'd had these kind of messages coming through to me about meetings, and a friend of mine had got, you know, sober in the other fellowship, and sort of it was rattling around my brain, and you know, all my life I'd been blaming my using on other people. It was, you know, it was because of my husband I was on heroin. Well, he never held a gun to my head, you know. everything was everybody else's fault. And I'd been talking to this girl who knew someone in recovery. And I said to her, that was my husband's fault. I was on the smack. I never really liked it. And she said to me, but that's what they all say. I said, oh, okay. And she told me about this boyfriend who'd been in NA. And she told me a little story about, you know, she'd had a relationship with him and blah, blah, blah. They'd had a fight and now she wasn't seeing him anymore, but he was still in NA. Anyway, so that was the night on Shepherd's Bush Green later on that I suddenly thought to myself, meeting. So what I did, I went home, I found the NA helpline and I rang it. And I found a meeting the very next day, and it was the Welcome to Newcomers in Notting Hill. Mm-hmm. And I thought, right, I'll go to that. And I went to work the next day. So I was dancing on the weekend, sometimes through the week, and I had another job at a market research company in Hammersmith a couple of days a week. So I went into work, and normally the boss, who was an alcoholic, she was straight to me as soon as I came in, fancy a drink, you know. And I said, no, I didn't have a drink. And I was very, I can't explain, I was in a very strange vibe, and I didn't use that day. And I got to the meeting, and it was all really fucking weird. I didn't understand what people were talking about. They could have been talking in any language. I certainly didn't understand it. And I was sitting there sort of sweating a bit. And it was a beautiful day and the windows were open. And there was a guy, somebody was playing bongos in the background in a flat behind. And some guy was sitting there like this going, I thought, what the fuck is going on here? So anyway, I didn't really hear anything. I didn't know what was going on. But somebody came up to me afterwards and said, are you a newcomer? I said, yeah. And she gave me a blue book, and she gave me a where to find, and she gave me her phone number. As it turned out, it was the wrong bloody number, because I tried to phone her. When I told her afterwards, she was mortified she'd give me the wrong number. But anyway, it didn't put me off, thank God. When I came out of that meeting, I got in my car and I phoned this friend of mine, whose best friend was in the other fellowship, and I said, I've just been to my first meeting. She said, wow. She said, make sure you get another one in before the weekend. I said, what, another? I thought I was cured from one meeting. So anyway, that was how I came to be in Narcotics Anonymous. And for me, it has been like learning another language, because it's the language of recovery. And we talk, you know, about spiritual principles and about honesty, and I didn't know what these things were. I didn't know how to be honest. I didn't know what the defect was. I didn't know anything. And I really, really felt like a baby learning to kind of walk and to talk, because I was never given any skills for life. Maybe, you know, it's in my DNA that I didn't have that. Maybe I wasn't taught it. I don't know. I don't care. Whatever reason, I couldn't do life. And this program has given me everything I need to be able to live life and live it clean. And I can't even express how much gratitude I have for that, because, you know, everything was slipping away from me. I got here in the nick of time. I didn't lose my flat. I didn't quite lose my sanity. It turned out when I was about 2 weeks clean, I found out I had Hep C. And you know, if the doctor had told me before that I had Hep C, you've got to stop drinking, you've got to stop doing all that shit, I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done it for myself. But I already made that decision, and, you know, then I found out I had it. So, you know, so it's been a long, really long, really slow process for me, and I'm just a slow learner, I think. But, you know, that's the way it is for me, and that's fine. I'm not running a race here. And I found myself a sponsor when I was about, I think, 60 days clean. And I started writing a journal when I was 60 days, and I still write it today. For me, that's my kind of daily step 10, and it keeps me in touch with, you know, my behaviour and what's going on around me and how I'm feeling about stuff, and it's really important. But I've had a lot of amazing things happen in recovery, and I knew instinctively that I needed to stay away from the opposite sex for a while because I knew I was very sick in that area, and I had a little opportunity of testing how sick I was when I was 2 years clean. I thought I was so well. And I had a three-month thing with someone kind of half in, half out of recovery. He was a really sick boy. And it just showed me how much I had to learn about myself and about relationships. And it's, you know, the relationship thing has been key for me. And my first sponsor taught me that, first of all, you have to have a relationship with yourself. You know, I didn't know who I was. I had absolutely no concept of the person I really was. But I remember coming to a point, I think it was around 5 years clean, and I sort of recognised myself. I thought, yeah, there you are. There you are. And, you know, it's been a process of getting to know myself. And I've just done the same as, you know, everybody's suggested to do. The only thing I didn't do is 90 and 90. I did my best, and I did about 5 or 6 meetings a week in the early days, and that was fine for me. You know, I had Hep C, I was very tired, I was working, and you know, so I did the best I could there, and you know, doing that as well, it got me talking to people. It got me, you know, I started to recognise faces around me and start to trust the process and start to talk about, you know, real stuff instead of bullshit. I was great at talking bullshit with people. That's all I did at work, you know. But reality and truth and honesty and feelings was new territory for me, and it was kind of scary, but at the same time incredibly liberating and empowering as well. And I had an amazing first sponsor. She was a psychotherapist as well. I mean, to be honest with you, I had full-on psychotherapy for 6 years. And that woman, I told her things that I'd never told another living soul. And she sat there and she didn't judge me. And, you know, she guided me, and she got me through the first kind of 6-7 steps. And then she kind of disappeared from my life. And I found it really hard in between sponsors. I felt very adrift without a sponsor there to guide me. But I found another sponsor, and she's still my sponsor now, you know. And she's great too, in a very different way. And the most beautiful thing, I think, that I've had the good fortune to have in my recovery is at last a loving, healthy relationship with a man that I respect and I really love. And, you know, it's extraordinary experience. As usual with me, I kind of dived in, you know, addict way, and we were kind of living together within about 3 months. But we grew together, and we kind of, you know, we just... It's soulmates, it really is, and it's extraordinary. And my husband travels a lot for work, and he had an opportunity to go to Dubai, and he said, "Do you think you could live there?" So I went out there for a trip while he was on a contract there, and I said yes. And so we moved out there, and we were there for 4 years. And the first thing I did when I went to visit him, first of all, was find if there was a fellowship. Because I thought, I can't do this without the fellowship. So I found the other fellowship, but they couldn't tell me where NA meetings were. It was all a bit underground. So I thought, okay, there's something there, I can go. As it happens, I ended up doing a lot of service for NA there, and there's an amazing fellowship, truly international. It's quite extraordinary. I ended up as regional delegate, and the first thing I did was I took on the job of representative for the first ever Middle East Convention, which took place in Turkey in, I think it was 2009? Anyway, so I went over to Turkey for that, and that was an extraordinary experience, meeting people from all over the place, and you know, connecting with other Middle Eastern people. And then when I took on the role as a regional delegate, I took part in the APF, which is the other side of the world to the EDM. And so it's the Asia-Pacific Forum, and it's all the communities that side of the world, from Hawaii over to the Middle East. And we all get together and help the smaller communities, the remote communities, with fellowship development and stuff like that. And so I met people from Nepal, from Bhutan, from Iran, from Philippines, from Hawaii, from, you know, just, it was just mind-blowing. So the first time I went, it was in Bahrain. The second time, it was in Bangladesh. And we all got really sick in Bangladesh. It was terrible. But it was amazing. It was just amazing. And there's a fellowship in Afghanistan now due to the efforts of the Iranian fellowship. I mean, it's just such an amazing thing to be part of. And it's just, you know, I love to share about it just because it's everywhere. You know, we are everywhere. And I really feel, because I'm one of these people, I can't watch the news, I can't read newspapers, I can't bear what's going on in the world. But, you know, when I see the effect of my own recovery in my small circle of friends and family, and the ripples, you know, how it affects other people, I know that with the fellowship, you know, like the UK fellowship here, the ripples spread out into the world. And I just believe that it's a really positive energy that we give here. And, you know, welcome to the newcomer. You're the most important person, and there is hope. And the thing is, I never ever thought that living clean, I thought my life was over. I thought, what am I going to do? I can't even drink. Are you serious? Of course, I didn't realise I was an alcoholic. That didn't occur to me. And, you know, I've been clean for 12 years. I've not had a drink or a drug. And this is extraordinary. But I couldn't do it without this programme. And not only, you know, doing even the smallest, you know, making the tea, taking the meeting, whatever service it is, I get far more back than I give out. And this is really true of sponsorship as well. I love my sponsees. I've got lots of sponsees. When I went to Dubai, there were very few women in the fellowship. There still are, unfortunately. But, you know, so I went along there, and suddenly there was someone with a bit more clean time, because there were a lot of newcomers, and I suddenly found myself with a clutch of sponsees. And I thought, my God, I don't know how to sponsor people, you know, but I don't have to be the burning bush. I just share my experience. That's all it is. That's all it is. And showing someone some compassion and listening to what they need to say and listening to their steps. And it's a privilege to do that. It really is. And, I don't know what else to say, really. I'm happy to be back. I found it quite hard, you know. I miss the people in Dubai. It's a very small fellowship there, and suddenly you come back to London and you've got this massive, bustling fellowship, you know. And sometimes you have to fight a bit for, you know, a bit of attention or to share in a meeting, and that's sometimes a good thing, because I didn't know how to speak up for myself when I came here. But I can speak now. I mean, I'm doing it. but, you know, it's not easy, or it wasn't for me, but it was a big key to my recovery, is being able to speak and be able to say how I felt. And, you know, this is a great gift that we've been given. And I was aware of that kind of from the beginning, and I hung on to this fellowship like a life raft, to be honest, because I didn't want more of the same that was out there anymore. Thank you very much. You know, I'm 55 now, and I've done all my using, God willing. I have a higher power today. That's kind of shifted and changed over the years. My thing is positive energy and universal love, that kind of thing, and that works for me. Yeah, and I work the steps, and I'm on my third set at the moment, and each time it's different. Each time it's a different level. And I kind of feel a bit adrift when I'm not working the steps, to be honest. I like doing it. I like to feel better. I like to move on and, you know, enjoy life. And that's what, you know, it gives me a bit of serenity when I do this stuff. And kind of that's what I want to feel. I don't want to feel... I had a situation not too long ago, actually, where I had a bit of a ding-dong with my sister-in-law, and I said some things I really shouldn't have said, and I hated myself for about 3 or 4 weeks. I absolutely hated myself for it. And I just don't want to do that to myself anymore. I can't do that to myself. So, you know, the thing to do is to get on with the steps, make amends, do all that stuff to the best of my ability, and there you go. There's hope for everyone, and I think I've run out of steam, actually. Have I run out of time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
You don't have to.
No, I think I'll leave it there, because I'll start waffling otherwise, and just thanks for listening to me and giving me this opportunity. Thanks.